Hi, this is Aaron from Gangland Wire. You're going to want to join me and Gary Jenkins for the 2018 Mob Summit in Las Vegas. That's right, folks. Las Vegas, baby. We're going to be there June 15th, 16th, and 17th. Three crime-filled days with author Frank Culotta. Gary Jenkins is going to be there as well, speaking about his app, talking about his movie, sharing his book, Leaving Vegas. And then Larry Henry of the Mafia Chronicles is going to be there as well, and many, many more. We're spending Friday evening mixing with the mob at the Plaza Hotel. Saturday from 9 to 1, we're in panel discussions about the mob. Saturday night, we're going to be rubbing elbows at the Mob Museum, and it continues Sunday from 9 to 1 p.m. at the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, baby. It's the 2018 Mob Summit.
Hello, my name is Frank Calabrese Jr. I am from Chicago. I was born and raised in Chicago. I am half Irish and half Italian. I followed my father and my uncle into the Chicago mob. I have written a book about my life. It's called Operation Family Secrets. It was number 14 on the New York Times bestseller list. I now have a tour. I am the tour guide. It's FamilySecretsTours.com. It runs in Chicago. And I want you to come on out, and I'll tell you firsthand about the life in Chicago outfit. You are listening to Gangland Wire.
If you like what you hear, go to GanglandWire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there in wiretapper land. I'm here in the classic old Ice House building in Midtown Kansas City with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight we did a teaser on this show last month. It's about the corporation. I hope you all went out and bought that book. If you didn't, after listening to tonight's show, you probably will go out and write that book. Matter of fact, this show may end up being two shows. It's one heck of a story. I have here with me my good friend and the chief investigator of Cuban organized crime operation called the Corporation, Dave Shanks. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you very much.
You know, folks, it's kind of interesting. I'm going to tell one quick little story on how I met Dave. Dave is he's retired Miami-Dade, right? Miami-Dade County?
That is correct.
Police officer, and ended up his career being a sworn federal agent working for the
U.S. Attorney's Office.
U.S. Attorney's Office. They have a strike force down there as U.S. Attorney's
It was the U.S. Attorney's Office. It was a strike force-like operation,
okay,
of which I was the head.
Okay.
So
Andrew Barrett's out there, my one of our super fans. I'll tell you right now, Andrew Barrett loves the podcast, and he lives in Kansas City, and we were communicating one time, and I found out that he belonged to the club where I like to go play golf at, the National. We're up there playing golf, and he said, you know the pro up here, Dave? I said, well, yeah, I know him. And he said, did you know he used to be a policeman? I said, oh, no. He's a head golf pro at the National. He said, no, he used to be a policeman. As a matter of fact, he said he wrote a book or something about some organized crime thing he did, and it's going to be made into a movie. I said, you're shitting me, Andrew. He said, no, I'm not kidding. So as soon as I got back in the clubhouse, he was there, and I asked him, and he said, oh, yeah, I did, in a suitably humble way. And, small world, huh?
Yeah, very small world.
Well, most people, you know, when they retire to Miami.
Yeah.
Not the other way around.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, I thought it was better for a lot of reasons to come to the Midwest. A, they wanted to pay me. That was, you know, one of the big things. And B, you know, my ex was much as distance I could between her and I. That was a great thing. So 1,500 miles worked out really well.
Well, you know, I guess there is some reasons to live in Kansas City.
There's some reasons. And, you know, I really like Kansas City. I really do. The only thing that I get, the knock on Kansas City I have is I grew up on the ocean or by the ocean my whole life. And, you know, it's a long way to get to an ocean from here, you know?
Yes, it is. And it's cold in the winter, too.
Yeah, so every winter I go back home and visit my kids and I spend time at the beach. And so I'm happy.
All right.
Well, and the book that you wrote is called, or the book that T.J. English wrote, it's released on March 20th, is called The Corporation, An Epic Story of the Cuban-American Underworld.
Quickly remind folks, a lot of you probably listened to the teaser. Remind folks, this is your story, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, it's a story of basically two people. It's a story of Jose Miguel Battle, and it's my story. And I have to, I originally wrote an 800-page, I thought was a wonderful.
A tome? 800-page tome?
Yeah, exactly. You know, War and Peace took me 2 years to do. But we couldn't get it sold. Nobody knew me. So we went to T.J. English, who's a well-known crime writer. And as soon as we brought him the subject, he jumped at the chance. He took my book and my manuscript and rewrote it and did a wonderful job with it. And he treated me very well in it. I mean, my agreement was all I had was on the facts of the case, and he could have said Dave Shanks,
Right.
But he didn't. He treated me very well, and I appreciate it.
And an added benefit of getting a guy like that on board and HarperCollins is that all of a sudden they sold the rights to a screenplay right off the bat.
That's right. Within 72 hours of HarperCollins signing on the dotted line, Paramount came knocking on her door and bought the whole project.
And how soon did Benicio del Toro come along?
Immediately. Benicio del Toro, we had approached him when it was just my manuscript, and he was tentatively on board. So that was one of the things. Once we had T.J. English's name on it and Benicio agreeing that he would play it if there was a good screenplay, once we got HarperCollins involved and Benicio signed immediately. Mm-hmm. And then Leonardo DiCaprio.
Your good buddy Leo. DiCaprio and the rest of us.
Yeah. Well, you could call him that because he's playing you.
Yeah, that's correct. He signed immediately to be the producer on it. He wanted at that point to produce a kind of an epic story. He's produced some small things, so he found this out and he signed on too. So he said that as long as, you know, the role is correct, he's going to play David Shanks, which is the funniest thing I can ever think of. I mean, you know, and a lot of other people think that. They look at me and look at Benicio and go, and look at Leonardo and go, I don't know.
Well, you're much tougher looking than he is. I'll tell you that right now.
Well, and the names have not been changed to protect the innocent.
No,
here.
They have not.
So in the movie, he will actually be David Shanks.
Yes. Is that you think they'll do that?
They're supposed to.
Oh, interesting.
But,
well,
you know, the truth of the matter is when you sign off on this, the movie company could do anything they want. You know, you have no control over it. And so they could, you know, they could make me Superman flying through buildings. You know, I can say nothing about it.
Yeah.
You know, the checks come in, that's fine. They want to, because we had, they already had hired one screenwriter who wrote something and I read it, and the only true fact in it was the name of Jose Miguel Battle and David Shanks. They fired him and they've hired someone else, and they've told him, we want us, since the story is so strong all on its own, they want a story that's based on the truth, not something that you make up out of your own imagination.
Yeah, well, cool. That's great. They're working with you on that. You know, there's the kind of the maybe not so famous, but there's a story about Joe Wamba, famous police writer.
I know. I've read most of Wamba's stuff.
Yeah, and he sold the rights to the Choir Boys, and they made that movie, and they made it into a joke, and he was so mad. He had sold him the rights to The Onion Field, and of course, that's about two coppers that get killed out there,
mm-hmm.
based on, and he bought the rights back and cut all ties, and he is not really... I guess he's not really had much to do with Hollywood.
Well, he produced it as a movie, a made-for-TV movie himself.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. It's a very strong... I saw it years and years ago when I was a young policeman. It was a very strong, intense movie, which was more true to his book than The Choir Boys. And The Choir Boys was a joke.
It was. It was a cartoon. It was like what a coked-out Hollywood, young Hollywood producer and director would want to do to make fun of everybody. But anyhow... So moving right along, enough of the movie business, and let's get down to your career. I'm really interested about the kind of the progression of your career. You got started as a young policeman, and as you progressed on, and ended up being involved in this investigation. So I think people would like to hear the backstory about how you got there.
Yeah, I got hired coming out of the military in 1974 by what was then called the Dade County Public Safety Department. And over the years, our department changed names. It became the Metro Dade Police Department, and then the Miami-Dade County Police Department. But it's still the same organization. And it was headed by a very well-respected man by the name of E. Wilson Purdy, who is a family friend. And my mom actually worked for him. And it was one of the reasons why I went to that department, because of E. Wilson. And there's some other things I can tell you another time about how I owe E. Wilson a debt of changing my life. He was a very good man. So anyway, I went to work for them, went to police, actually delivered mail while I was waiting to get into police academy for a year.
Oh, wow.
I used to have to drive around in an old beat up, painted out police car and drive the mail, because Dade County, if you don't know, is 50 miles wide and 50 miles long.
Oh, from station to station, the interdepartmental.
Oh, yeah. It used to take the station to station mail, you know. And I would put 120 miles on my car every day I delivered mail. The only day that everybody wanted to see me was when I can't, because back then they didn't have the direct deposit. It was when I bought the checks to this outlying station that everybody was my friend. Yeah. So I got into police academy, graduated. I originally worked in Liberty City, which was a very tough neighborhood. We had riots in there in 1980.
I remember that. Those were pretty bad riots.
Well, lead up to it, one of my first months that I was on the police department, we had three officers killed, three detectives from the auto theft section, and they had run up against a guy who they thought was just a normal everyday auto thief, but it was a guy who was a three-time loser and didn't want to go back to jail, so he shotgunned all three of them to death.
Wow.
And then committed suicide himself. And that was one of the first incidents for me, you know, that I was there, and one of the police lieutenants, you know, brought a bunch of us into the morgue and pulled the bodies off of the sheets off the police officers, and basically said, "This is what happens when you get lax in this job." So it was one of the first things that happened. Then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, 1979, one of my best friends was killed on the department. Him and two other officers were shot trying to apprehend somebody who was he was an Army deserter who had come back home because his wife had sent him a Dear John letter, and he was going to take her hostage and try to convince her. And so it ended up by a number of misadventures that three policemen were shot, and I was on the scene, and Billy was my good friend, and he basically died right in front of me. After that, it's still a memory.
Yeah, I can see, I can tell. Yeah.
So after that, I end up going down to, they transferred all of it. They had the riots in 80. So the administration's answer was, well, okay, we're going to transfer everybody out. And I went to work in one of the district stations. I eventually ran a unit where I was the supervisor, where we would basically follow crime trends on the night shifts and the midnight shifts. And we would do things like hide on top of buildings in areas where we thought we were going to get burglarized. And we'd wait for people to do, you know, crimes. And we did, did all kinds of stuff. I once traded to an auto theft ring. I traded 2 ounces of Babo soap powder for a brand new Cadillac that had just been stolen 5 minutes before.
Wow.
I bet that guy was mad when he tried to snort that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it didn't last too long because as soon as he took the Babo and we got the car, we
took him off.
Took him off.
Yeah.
From there, I morphed into detective bureau functions. I had worked with a good friend of mine by the name of Jimmy Leggett, who's now passed on from natural causes. But Jimmy and I were neighbors. We were partners in Liberty City. We were really good friends. And he came to me one day and said, you know, there's an opening in organized crime bureau, and, you know, you could be my partner. I jumped at the chance. The lieutenant was a guy who was in my academy class. You know, I never, you know, went up for a lieutenant, a captain, anything like that, because I was happy doing police work.
Yeah.
I liked doing the day-to-day police work. That was really what I enjoyed doing. I got into police work as a temporary stopgap. You know, I was gonna try to go back into the military, but it didn't work. So Jimmy, I jumped at this, and the lieutenant was also an academy mate, and he said, you know, come and work. You know, we've got a lot of work, and you'd be perfect for it. I left a pretty good job in the robbery homicide area to go work in organized crime.
Okay.
We were strictly go out there and try to work cases. You know, we did a lot of wiretaps. At one point, I had written, at one point in my career, this U.S. Attorney's Office said, "You've written more wiretaps than any other person in the country on organized crime." And I said, "Well, you know, I wrote a lot of them." So we were very proactive. Knowing that most organized crime started out in some way or form with illegal gambling or prostitution or cargo thefts. I mean, that's what we worked. We would work small cases and see if we could get it up to a more important place, do a wiretap, and then, you know, go from there.
So you worked or small organizations.
We started with small organizations and tried to work them up into larger ones.
Try to find a guy that was involved and maybe put a tail on him and see who his friends were and then work it out from there.
We used to have a squad of guys who were great because they'd been doing it for years. Who were great surveillance people. And our axiom wasn't like when early in my career where was part of a surveillance where a young kid was kidnapped and you don't want to lose the guy. But our theory was, okay, we would figure out, we would get on him, we'd follow him, we'd find out who we dealt with and so on and so forth. And if we lost him, that was fine. We'd go back the next day and we'd follow him again, and then we'd get a little bit further, and then we'd see him and meet this person and meet that person. And I wrote more pen registers and trap and trace orders than pretty much anybody in the history of my department. And so we would go for their phones, and we'd eventually, if the case didn't lead anywhere significant, then we would do a search warrant, and we'd prosecute those people, see what information we could get from their books and analyze whatever we could when we did the search warrants of their records and things, and find other connections if we hadn't done a wiretap on it.
So now, folks, we've used a little bit of technical terminology here. I want to explain a little bit of it to you. And I know y'all know what a wiretap is because we talked about them a lot on this show. But a pen register usually is what you do before you get a wiretap. You think somebody's on a phone, you know kind of what phone they might be using. So, but it's hard to get the actual get the court order to actually listen. But it's a lot easier to get an order to just record the numbers. And so a pen register records all the ingoing and out, incoming and outgoing numbers.
And actually, a pen register actually comes from the old way of doing it, where it actually was a pen where, you know, the old dial phones, and you would hear click, 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 click.
Oh, yeah?
It would count the clicks. And then it would, you know.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, that's why it's called a pen register. A pen register, in my day, we would hook up one of two machines called a Hikimian machine or a Bartek. Bartek was the new computerized version. And that would record just the numbers that were dialed out by the phone, and it would record any incoming. It would record the length of the call, and it wouldn't record where a phone call came in from. That's why you had to get a trap and trace.
Okay.
Now the modern ones, but at the time that by the time I retired, at the age of the caller ID, they were able to produce machines that could do everything at one time, get the incoming and the outgoing at the same time. So by the time I left, we were doing a combined pen register and trap and trace order. And you're right. To get those are relatively easy in comparing to wiretap. I mean, this thing about TV where detective goes, "I want a wire on his phone," and
yeah, really.
5 minutes later, they're listening.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen. Most of my wiretap applications were 100 to 120 pages.
Yeah.
And, you know, you had to prove that it was the only way that, or show to a judge, it was the only way that you could prove this crime was by listening to the telephone calls. And then you had to prove that you know, you'd exhausted all other means in which to do it. So it was getting a wiretap is still to this day a very tough thing to do. Americans value their privacy quite a bit. Now, I worked with later in years with different other countries about it, and other countries it's like the television. I mean, in Holland, I worked with part of the case in Holland, and they go, "Oh, 5 minutes, we can get up on any phone you want, you know, turn it on,
cool.
You know." But you know, that's a whole different bag of worms there.
Can you imagine conducting moving surveillances with the GPS locator now?
I mean, they started to have that when I first started.
Oh, did
in.
They?
Oh, yeah.
I never got to use one.
Oh, yeah, they were pretty cool. You still have to have a court order to do that, you know, most of the time. So, like I said, we were very good at our surveillance. We knew we could follow anybody and get them to wherever we wanted to most of the time.
What about putting in like a bug a wire in the room versus a
well, I came in and before you guys came in to later, I put a room bug in here. Yeah, I did. We did those two. We bug later, and as part of my investigation, we bugged basically a clubhouse to the organized crime to listen in on their conversations. So yeah, that's also a it's not as tough as a wiretap, but it's pretty tough to get. Again, it's not one of those things where you just kind of black bag job where you just go do it.
Just go do it.
Yeah.
Sit outside in your car and listen to them.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a lot more complicated than the television and movies portray it, but it's doable.
And then the next several weeks is much more complicated than movies or television. You got to have a huge crew of people to let people know who's on the phone and who's in there and who's not. And you have to be able to react with the mobile crew if something goes down somebody's going, you got to be able to react.
Exactly.
18 hours a day.
I used to have to have crews when I ran wiretaps. We'd have to have surveillance crews. We'd have multiple monitors, you know, because we'd have to listen to it. Luckily, we knew that with our wiretaps that, you know, after midnight to 7 o'clock in the morning, we were down, so we didn't have to worry about stuff. But, you know, the rest of the hours we had to operate.
Who brought those big magnetic tapes that you see when they're in the van, you know, when it's reel to reel?
Well, when I did it, we did cassette tapes. Now the new modern technology, it's all computer generated, but we did cassette tapes.
Yeah.
And we had the process was you had to have one of these machines that would record and make two copies simultaneously. And one of my jobs as the lead investigator was at the end of the night, after I'd been there for 12 hours or better, would then take and seal up one copy, which was deemed the original, take it and put it in the property room at 2 o'clock in the morning. When I ran wiretaps, we usually did it out of apartments, and I had we'd make sure there was an extra bedroom so I could sleep there. So I spent years doing those things.
Wow, I know there are a ton. Only did one. We had it for a short period of time. We had the state statute in Missouri, and we did one. And like I was not ready to do another one. It was just so incredibly hard. So we got you up to doing this kind of work. And so when did you first get into Jose Miguel Battle and the corporation?
Well, in 1988, I had Jimmy Legan and I had done a case on a small-time gambler, which we couldn't get any link up to anybody bigger. We made a decision that we were just going to do a search warrant on the place. And so we went in there, we busted down the door, caught them in the act, because that's what we used to try to do. If we're going to do a search warrant, we're going to do it while they're operating, you know, catch them in the act. Then all of the times we would take over the telephone and take bets from unsuspecting customers. I used to have this pattern down. Oh, yeah. Yeah, Luis, he got sick. He went to the hospital. He had called me. I'm taking over for a minute, so give me a damn bet. Let's go. And so we'd record all that. We'd impounded a whole bunch of records from this gentleman. So we used to have an ex-IRS agent who worked for our organized crime bureau. He'd retired from the IRS, and his name was Max Schumann. Max was a real nice guy. But anyway, he would take our records and go through it. So I remember about a week after we did this search warrant, Max Schumann comes running in the office to Jimmy and I, and he goes, "You don't believe who you got here." I says, "Who do you got?" He says, "This is guy, look at this." And then he showed me this thing, and he says, "This is a corporation operation." And I had already heard about the corporation from Jimmy, because Jimmy, in 3 years before that, 1985, had gone to New York City and testified in front of the President's Commission on Organized Crime. And one of the officers who testified about the corporation and Jose Miguel Battle. So I'd already known about it. So that caused a little bit of a stir that this was actually a battle operation. We started, we got permission to start doing a more extensive case. And point out the interesting thing in the 1985 President's Commission, they brought in a one of the Battle's higher echelon who was afraid that Battle was going to kill him. And he testified under the conditions that he had to wear clothing that wouldn't be recognized, so they put him in a black judge's robe, and they put a hood over him, a black hood, and he actually talked to someone else who answered for him, so that the corporation people couldn't recognize his voice. So he was referred to as the Hooded Witness. I got to know much more about him later on in years. So one of the things that I had read, they had just had a war with the Italian families because the corporation had started after the Bay of Pigs, and Jose Miguel Battle came back from the Bay of Pigs. He was known as the bravest man on the Bay of Pig Beach, and he had spent a year and a half in Castro's hellhole of a jail. And President Kennedy, basically trying to honor, you know, the fact that they didn't back him up, they paid $56 million to Castro to release all the prisoners that had been involved in the Bay of Pigs and their families. So when he came back, he spent a year in the U.S. Army because they offered all of the Bay of Pigs veterans commissions in the Army if they wanted to, and Battle took them up on it, but he didn't fit into, because he was a brave man, but he wasn't one to take orders.
Right.
So after a year, the U.S. Army and him went their separate ways. So he went to Santo Trafficante Jr., who he had worked for in Havana as a crooked Havana policeman, and asked to form a family underneath the Italian mafia. So they agreed. Trafficante introduced him to the five family members in New York City. He introduced him to Sam, the plumber, Cavalcante, who was the crime boss of northern New Jersey. Battle War operated for the next 20 years underneath the Italian mafia. And, of course, you know, as the old saying was, letting them get their beak wet. So he would pay up a percentage of everything they made up to the Italian families. So just a few years before I got involved in the case, the corporation and the old Italian families, they had a thing called the two-block rule. Was that if an Italian mafioso had a spot, you know, illegal gambling or whatever in a certain location, the corporation wouldn't open up a competing spot within that two blocks. Well, things started to break down between them. They started, you know, arguments. A guy by the name of Vincent Caffaro, his nickname was the Fish, he was the go-between between the Italian mafia and the Battle people. Everything broke down. They started burning each other out. This three-year-old girl, who was just about 2 days away from turning 4 years old, by the name Janine Toribio, died in one of these fires, an innocent victim. That was the thing that got me, is like most people didn't know about this guy. I mean, you know, in New York City, northern New Jersey, in Miami, you knew about him. You knew how violent he was, his predilection towards settling things with violence. That was the one that got me, and that's what hooked me on the case. And we started working a bigger case, and the always aim was to work my way up from the street level up in the higher echelons of the corporation. We took that small case and we started working it. We first started getting intelligence by, he loved to bet gamble, you know, besides doing an organization that in 2007, we got a jury conviction for $1.5 billion. That's a billion with a B.
Wow.
That he made in his time. He loved to gamble and he loved cockfights. So we started gaining intelligence about his inner circle by raiding cockfights that were big prevalent in the Miami area. From that, we started to figure out who was who. Plus, there was a detective in New York City by the name of Richie Califas. Interesting character. What's that old show where they had the Arizona police officer who worked in New York City?
Oh, yeah. Well,
McLeod.
McLeod. Yeah, he was McLeod.
He was a real-life McLeod. He was born in Texas, out in the middle of there, and his family owned, what I learned later, he told me, four sections. And I said, oh, four sections. And I go, I found out later that's like 2,000 square miles or some ridiculous large amount of property. But he met and married a New York girl, and so he went on the NYPD. Mm-hmm. So he wore the 10-gallon hat to work and the cowboy boots, the whole nine yards. But he was a compendious knowledge of the crime that the corporation had committed in New York City. So he and I became very, very close. We worked together. And we started building more and more information about who was in the Florida clique and, you know, who was in the New York clique and who was in the New Jersey clique. And, you know, we had other things that were going on in Tampa and other cities. They had extended all the way west into Texas, but not very much. Okay. It's mostly East Coast.
So, Dave, these separate cliques, shall we call them, maybe subsets, they call those, in the Crips and the Bloods, a set and a subset, and units or whatever, each one was kind of stood on its own, and did they have a kind of a hierarchy?
Oh, they had a hierarchy. Yes,
in each set.
Battle was the Godfather. He had seen the Godfather movies, and he was just a big fan of them.
Oh, really?
Later years, we found that he watched probably the Godfather's movies 1, 2, I don't know if 3, but 1 and 2 at least 50 times, 100 times. He fashioned his organization, plus his dealings with Traficante and Cavalcante and Louis Mana and Tony Salerno, all those guys. He fashioned himself after them. He had a subset. So he had usually there was 4 people that were in the top echelon, we found by investigation. Him, his son, a guy by the name of Abraham Rids, who was a Cuban Polish Jew of Jewish dissension, and another guy, one of his nephews. No, he actually married his sister, so it was his brother-in-law by the name of Manuel Nene Marcus. And they were the top echelon. And then from them, they all had different areas that they were responsible for. Battle's brother, Gustavo, was responsible for illegal gambling machines, and Battle worked with the Colombian drug cartels. Later, they took their money and they put it into that. They had another crews that worked, cargo thefts. Anything you wanted to do, they would get into it and make money.
So each one of these cliques up along the East Coast, mm-hmm. then did each one of them have some gambling, some bolito, some...
Most of them started with...
cargo thefts, some narcotics, part uh-huh. of the narcotics. Of course, the narcotics all had to come out of Colombia, so they probably coordinated that.
Oh, yeah, Battle was on first-name terms with Pablo Escobar. Okay. We discovered that in later years. But yeah, mainly what they tried to do is they tried to keep the gambling away from the other things, mm-hmm. because they knew that most police organizations looked at penny ante stuff. So they would take their money. Battle said one time in a recorded conversation, he told a drug lord, he says, you know, you get your money, it's like a faucet. You turn it on and a lot of money comes out of this faucet. Then it shuts down. And then for 6 months or a year, you don't get anything more while you're waiting to get another big load through. He says, I got to turn on a faucet and it's a slow drip. Every day it produces money. Every day it produces money. The bolita, the prostitution, all this stuff produces money. Then I get this big pile of money and then I invest it with you guys. And then I get another large pile of money. So he was very, very savvy about how to make billions of dollars through these illegal organizations, which most people thought of as penny ante. But the truth of the matter is he enforced his will by killing people. We believe that he killed over 100 people during his tenure.
Even though he was never really convicted on more than a handful of...
Well, you know, when we did the... When he was convicted on a homicide back in the 70s, and then he went on an appeal, and then we convicted him on 6 homicides in 2007. So, but it was a case of, okay, we charge it. We pick our 6 best homicides to go after him, because otherwise we'd have just spent forever talking about these homicides. And he got convicted of the 8 arson deaths, that the best ones we could prove up also. You know, we convicted him of 14 different counts of homicide.
That was really smart, keeping the gambling separate from the narcotics.
Oh, yeah.
This guy was...
And in point of fact, he would, if you were a gambler and you got involved in narcotics without his permission, you were cut out. Hmm. You were cut out.
Interesting. All right. Well, you know, folks, we're gonna have 2 parts on this episode. It's again, it's a lot of information and it's complex, and you probably need some time to digest this. It's a fascinating story. It's one that I didn't know anything about, especially the whole thing about the Cuban organization working directly under the Italian mob organizations. That's amazing. I never heard that before. All the reading I've done and
I've never seen anything like that. Certainly in Kansas City, that would never happen, I'll tell you right now.
Well, but, you know, they worked very hand in hand. The Teflon Don, what's his name? I can't think
Gotti,
of it.
Gotti, yeah.
He worked with Gotti, and he worked with, you know, the other heads of the organization and the five families. So
I know that was kind of my question to Gary, is we could kind of talking about this before you came in and how he could come in and kind of come into Jersey, which would have already had a family there, and start running this Bolito and these, you know, gambling and vice, and without them saying, hey, you know, this is our turf.
Well, now we know. He already had a deal with them, and he was paying them all along,
too. He was paying them, you know. And at one time, he had as many as 2,000 soldiers that Battles organization did.
Wow.
That were out there working for him, which was a lot more than the Italians had, really, by the time the 70s and 80s came out.
Yeah, that's true. All right, folks, we're going to go into a little ending here, and we will talk to you all next week. Dave, you'll come back next week, won't you?
I sure will.
All right, great. If you have a friend or a relative has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, ladies and gentlemen, you need to go out and get the book, The Corporation, An Epic Story of the Cuban-American Underworld by T.J. English, although it was actually written by David Shanks, the officer who lived the life, who wrote the story, who was the man from the mouth of the men that did it. And of course, you want to go out and get the Gangland Wire, the documentary that started it all, available on Amazon to buy or to rent. And more great mob material from Gary Jenkins, including the Kansas City Mob Tour. For $1.99, you can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And if that's not enough, get Gary's latest book, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And we're on Amazon, too. Our book's on Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well, there is that, and of course you could go anytime you visit the Gangland Wire website, and you're looking to buy something on Amazon, click on the gun that says with the link to Amazon, and you'll wet the beaks of Gangland Wire.
Yeah, Dave talked about wetting the beaks up the mob families up north. What about wetting the beak of Gangland Wire, folks? Just anything you want to buy on Amazon. Go to my website, click on that link, and we get a little piece of that action, and it doesn't cost you a dime.
Or you could just make a donation and become one of the mob members of Gangland Wire.
Because you notice we have one public service announcement that goes real fast, and we don't have any sponsors. We don't want to take up your time trying to sell you too much. All right, say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic
Music. Chronological progression, I guess. And then when we get into, I'm trying to think, this is probably maybe a couple of 30 or 40 minute episodes. You got time for that?
Yeah, I got it. I got time.
Because you got a lot of material. Get my clock here so I can remember. Watch the time. So we just got to stop and then start back up. It's like
okay. We're
doing the second show. And so I'm thinking maybe in that first one, kind of your career and getting up into this investigation. If we go back when you get into this, probably the second show would be more about this.
Okay.
Probably a little bit about your initial getting into how'd you figured out there was a corporation, you were working on that and gathering intelligence on it and getting informants in it and kind of that early process. But there's probably some point in time when it took on a little more seriousness.
We knew about the corporation. My partner, rest his soul. He had already testified of the, because I was working another detective function.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Leggett said, you know, come work with me, you know. And we had worked in Liberty City together. We'd worked through the riots together. We were neighbors. I mean, you know, we'd known each other for a lot of years. So there was an opening and I took it in Organized Crime Bureau and just to be with Jimmy's partner. And I had already had the lowdown on the corporation when we started. And the bottom line is we took a little case, which turns into related to the corporation, and we just started building from there.
Okay, yeah. I think maybe your early career and then up to as that starts to build there, you get to organized crime bureau and work on Jimmy Leggett, and then it starts to build up. And probably there will be about a decent breaking point.
Okay.
And then after that, it probably that's when it started taking on a real seriousness. And people, other people start getting interested, and you got resources, and the feds got feds involved, I imagine, and that kind of stuff.
Well, the thing was... the thing about it was back then, as you probably you know, you worked organized crime, and I worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office. I mean, if you wanted to get involved in an organized crime case back then, all you had to do is say Italian.
Yeah.
All right? And everybody came running.
Yeah.
You know, when we sit, talking with federal agencies about Cuban organized crime, they're just like,
okay.
So we had to go work from the inside out. We worked the case locally, and then the head prosecutor locally became a federal prosecutor, and then so he brought me along, and then it became more and more, then it became the snowball. But I mean, there was a lot of years that I worked this all by myself.
Yeah.
I mean, just pretty much. And
so that would be a good to get to that, past that, to where your guy then starts taking on more importance.
That's right,
like
yes.
a good natural break, and then we go into the, okay. you know, that of it. And as far as like going back to laying the groundwork on him, probably I do it a little bit, but just a little bit.
Okay.
You know, he's a Bay of Pigs, like, you know, that.
Yeah, because the teaser episode is going to come out here.
It's going to have that.
It might
already.
Be another month before the actual.
Yeah. Yeah, so I want to at least touch on a little bit of that, what you said, but not at length. Most people that listen to this podcast listen to every one of them.
Okay.
I mean, it's like clockwork. It's amazing.
Yeah.
We don't have a whole shitload of fans, not enough to get ads, but we've got dedicated fans that listen to every podcast.
There's more than you two, right?
Yeah.
Okay, then we're good to go.
Yeah. Well, they tell, you know, they're like, oh, when you get to 1,000 people, people will be interested in advertising. We're past that, and they're still not really interested.
Well, you can get about 50,000. Oh, well.
Yeah, we're doing like 20,000 a month because they come in, they listen to this episode, and then they'll
go back and listen
go
to
back.
New people. Go back and listen to all of them. So, okay. All right, Aaron, you ready?
Yep. I'm bringing everybody down.
First, I used the term LAIU. That's Law Enforcement Intelligence Units, which that's what I was a member of. And we never worked cases particularly. We just gathered information, gathered intelligence, and then fed it to somebody like Dave, and who actually took the action, went out and worked the cases and did the wiretaps and did warrants and made arrests.
We actually had a small group of four who were hooked into LAIU, and they were the intelligence gatherers, and they would feed us information. So, yeah.